This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Season of Storms, written by Andrei Sapkowski, translated by David French, read by Peter Kenny.
Battle not with monsters, lest ye become a monster. For if you gaze into the abyss gazes back into you. Friedrich Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil.
I consider gazing into the abyss utter foolishness. There are many things in the world much more worth gazing into.
Dandelion, Half a Century of Poetry. Chapter 1. It lived only to kill. It was lying on the sun-warmed sand. It could sense the vibrations being transmitted through its hair-like feelers and bristles. Though the vibrations were still far off, the Aedir could feel them distinctly and precisely. It was thus able to determine not only its quarry's direction and speed of movement, but also its weight. As with most similar predators, the weight of the prey was of cardinal importance. Stalking, attacking, and giving chase meant a loss of energy that had to be compensated by the calorific value of its food. Most predators, similar to the Aedir, would quit their attack if their prey was too small. But not the Aedir. The Aedir didn't exist to eat and sustain the species. It hadn't been created for that. It lived to kill. Moving its limbs cautiously, it exited the hollow, crawled over a rotten tree trunk, covered the clearing in three bounds, plunged into the fern-covered undergrowth, and melted into the thicket. It moved swiftly and noiselessly, now running, now leaping like a huge grasshopper. It sank into the thicket and pressed the segmented carapace of its abdomen to the ground. The vibrations in the ground became more and more distinct. The impulses from the Aedir's feelers and bristles formed themselves into an image, into a plan. The Aedir now knew where to approach its victim from, where to cross its path, how to force it to flee, how to swoop on it from behind with a great leap, from what height to strike and lacerate with its razor-sharp mandibles. Within it, the vibrations and impulses were already arousing the joy it would experience when its victim started struggling under its weight, arousing the euphoria that the taste of hot blood would induce in it, the ecstasy it would feel when the air was rent by a scream of pain. It trembled slightly, opening and closing its pinces and pedipalps. The vibrations in the ground were very distinct and had also diversified. The Aedir now knew there was more than one victim. Probably three or perhaps four. Two of them were shaking the ground in a normal way. The vibrations of the third suggested a small mass and weight. The fourth, meanwhile, provided there really was a fourth, was causing irregular, weak and hesitant vibrations. The Aedir stopped moving, tensed, and extended its antennae above the grass, examining the movements of the air. The vibrations in the ground finally signaled what the Aedir had been waiting for. Its quarry had separated. One of them, the smallest, had fallen behind. And the fourth, the vague one, had disappeared. It had been a fake signal, a false echo. The Aedir ignored it. The smallest target moved even further away from the others. The trembling in the ground was more intense and closer. The Aedir braced its rear limbs, pushed off, and leapt. The little girl gave an ear-splitting scream. Rather than running away, she had frozen to the spot and was screaming unremittingly. The Witcher darted towards her, drawing his sword mid-leap, and realized at once that something was wrong, that he'd been tricked. The man pulling a handcart loaded with faggots screamed and shot 6 feet up into the air in front of Geralt's eyes, blood spraying copiously from him. He fell, only to immediately fly up again, this time in two pieces, each spurting blood. He'd stopped screaming. Now the woman was screaming piercingly, and, like her daughter, was petrified and paralyzed by fear. Although he didn't believe he would, the Witcher managed to save her. He leapt and pushed hard, throwing the blood-spattered woman from the path into the forest among the ferns, and realized at once that this time, too, it had been a trick, a ruse. For the flat, grey, many-limbed and incredibly quick shape was now moving away from the handcart and its first victim. It was gliding towards the next one, towards the still shrieking little girl. Geralt sped after the Eidir. Had she remained where she was, he would have been too late. But the girl demonstrated presence of mind and bolted frantically. The grey monster, however, would easily have caught up with her, killed her, and turned back to dispatch the woman too. That's what would have happened, had it not been for the Witcher. He caught up with the monster and jumped, pinning down one of its rear limbs with his heel. If he hadn't jumped aside immediately, he would have lost a leg. The grey creature twisted around with extraordinary agility, and its curved pincers snapped shut, missing him by a hair's breadth. Before the Witcher could regain his balance, the monster sprang from the ground and attacked. Geralt defended himself instinctively, with a broad and rather haphazard swing of his sword that pushed the monster away. He hadn't wounded it, but now he had the upper hand. He sprang up and fell on the monster, slashing backhand, cleaving the carapace of the flat cephalothorax. Before the dazed creature came to its senses, a second blow hacked off its left mandible. The monster attacked, brandishing its limbs and trying to gore him with its remaining mandible like an aurochs. The Witcher hacked that one off too. He slashed one of the Eidir's pedipalps with a swift reverse cut, then hacked at the cephalothorax again. It finally dawned on the Eidir that it was in danger, that it must flee. Flee far from there, take cover, find a hiding place. It only lived to kill. In order to kill, it must regenerate, it must flee. Flee! The Witcher didn't let it. He caught up with it, stepped on the rear segment of the thorax, and cut from above with a fierce blow. This time, the carapace gave way, and viscous greenish fluid gushed and poured from the wound. The monster flailed around, its limbs thrashing the ground chaotically. Geralt cut again with his sword, this time completely severing the flat head from the body. He was breathing heavily. It thundered in the distance. The growing wind and darkening sky heralded an approaching storm. Right from their very first encounter, Albert Smulka, the newly appointed district reeve, reminded Geralt of a Swede. He was stout, unwashed, thick-skinned, and generally pretty dull. In other words, he didn't differ much from all the other district clerks Geralt had dealt with.
"Words seem to be true," said the Reeve. "Not like a Witcher for dealing with troubles. Jonas, my predecessor, couldn't speak highly enough of you," he continued a moment later, not waiting for any reaction from Geralt. "To think I considered him a liar. I mean, that I didn't completely lend credence to him. I know how things can grow into fairy tales, particularly among the common folk. With them there's always either a miracle or a marvel or some witcher with superhuman powers. And here we are, turns out it's the honest truth. Uncounted people have died in that forest beyond the little river, and because it's a shortcut to the town, the fools went that way. To their own doom. Heedless of warnings. These days it's better not to loiter in badlands or wander through forests. Monsters and man-eaters everywhere. A dreadful thing just happened in the Tukai Hills of Temeria. A sylvan ghoul killed 15 people in a charcoal burner settlement. It's called Rogovitsna. You must have heard, haven't you? But it's the truth. Cross my heart and hope to die. It's said even the wizardry have started an investigation in that there Rogovitsna. Well, enough of stories. We're safe here in Ansigis now, thanks to you.
He took a coffer from a chest of drawers, spread out a sheet of paper on the table, and dipped a quill in an inkwell.
"You promised you'd kill the monster," he said without raising his head. "Seems you weren't having me on. You're a man of your word, for a vagabond. And you saved those people's lives. That woman and the lass. Did they even thank you? Express their gratitude?"
"No, they didn't." The Witcher clenched his jaw. "Because they haven't yet fully regained consciousness, and I'll be gone before they do. Before they realize I used them as bait.
convinced in my conceited arrogance that I was capable of saving all three of them. I'll be gone before it dawns on the girl, before she understands I'm to blame for her becoming a half-orphan. He felt bad, no doubt because of the elixirs he'd taken before the fight. No doubt. That monster is a right abomination. The Reeve sprinkled some sand over the paper, then shook it off onto the floor. I had a look at the carcass when they brought it here. What on earth was it? Geralt wasn't certain in that regard, but didn't intend to reveal his ignorance. An arachnomorph. Albert Snulker moved his lips, vainly trying to repeat the word. Ah, makes no difference, when all's said and done. Did you dispatch it with that sword? With that blade? Can I take a look? No, you can't. Ah, because it's no doubt enchanted, and it must be dear. Quite something. Well, here we are, drawn away, and time's passing. The task's been executed, time for payment. But first the formalities. Make your mark on the bill. I mean, put a cross or some such.
The Witcher took the bill from Smulker and held it up to the light.
Look at him!
The Reeve shook his head, grimacing.
What's this? Can he read?
Geralt put the paper on the table and pushed it towards the official.
A slight error has crept into the document, he said calmly and softly. We agreed on 50 crowns. This bill has been made out for 80.
Albert Smulker clasped his hands together and rested his chin on them.
It isn't an error.
He also lowered his voice.
Rather, a token of gratitude. You killed the monster, and I'm sure it was an exacting job. So, the sum won't astonish anyone.
I don't understand.
Pull the other one. Don't play the innocent. Trying to tell me that when Jonas was in charge, he never made out bills like this. I swear I...
What do you swear? Geralt interrupted.
That he inflated bills. I went halves with me on the sum the royal purse was deprived of. Went halves? The Reeve sneered. Don't be soft, Witcher. Don't be soft. Reckon you're that important? You'll get a third of the difference. 10 crowns. It's a decent bonus for you anyway. For I deserve more, if only owing to my function. State officials ought to be wealthy. The wealthier the official, the greater the prestige to the state. Besides, what would you know about it? This conversation's beginning to weary me. You signing it or what?
The rain hammered on the roof. It was pouring down outside, but the thunder had stopped. The storm had moved away. Interlude. 2 days later.
Do come closer, madam.
Bilohan, King of Kerak, beckoned imperiously.
Do come closer. Servants, a chair.
The chamber's vaulting was decorated with a plafond of a fresco, depicting a sailing ship at sea, amidst mermen, hippocampi, and lobster-like creatures. The fresco on one of the walls, however, was a map of the world. An absolutely fanciful map, as Coral had long before realized, having little in common with the actual locations of lands and seas, but pleasing and tasteful. Two pages lugged in and set down a heavy carved curule seat. The sorceress sat down, resting her hands on the armrests, so that her ruby-encrusted bracelets would be very conspicuous and not escape the king's attention. She had a small ruby tiara on her coiffed hair, and a ruby necklace in the plunging neckline of her dress, all especially for the royal audience. She wanted to make an impression, and had. King Bilohan stared goggle-eyed, though it wasn't clear whether at the rubies or the cleavage. Bilohan, son of Osmic, was, it could be said, a first-generation king. His father had made quite a considerable fortune from maritime trade, and probably also a little from buccaneering. Having finished off the competition and monopolized the region's cabotage, Osmic named himself king. That act of self-anointed coronation had actually only formalized the status quo, and hence did not arouse significant quibbles nor provoke protests. Over the course of various private wars and skirmishes, Osmic had smoothed over border disputes and jurisdictional squabbles with his neighbours, Verden and Sidaris. It was established where Kerak began, where it finished, and who ruled there. And since he ruled, he was king, and deserved the title. By the natural order of things, titles and power pass from father to son. So no one was surprised when Bilohan ascended his father's throne, following Osmic's death. Osmic admittedly had more sons, at least four of them, but they had all renounced their rights to the crown, one of them allegedly even of his own free will. Thus, Bilohan had reigned in Kerak for over 20 years, deriving profits from shipbuilding, freight, fishery and piracy, in keeping with family traditions. And now King Bilohan, seated on a raised throne, wearing a sable kalpak, and with a scepter in one hand, was granting an audience, as majestic as a dung beetle on a cowpat.
"Our dear Madam Litanir," he greeted her, "our favourite sorceress, Litanir. She has deigned to visit Kerak again, and surely for a long stay again."
"The sea air's good for me." Coral crossed her legs provocatively, displaying a booty with fashionable cork heels.
"With the gracious permission of your Royal Highness."
The king glanced at his son sitting beside him. Both were tall and slender, quite unlike their father, who was bony and sinewy, but not of very imposing height. Neither did they look like brothers. The older, Egmund, had raven black hair, while Xander, who was a little younger, was almost albino blonde. Both looked at Litta with dislike. They were evidently annoyed by the privilege that permitted sorceresses to sit in the presence of kings, and that such seated audiences were granted to them. The privilege was well established, however, and could not be flouted by anyone wanting to be regarded as civilized. And Bilohan's sons very much wanted to be regarded as civilized.
"We graciously grant our permission," Bilohan said slowly, "with one proviso."
Coral raised a hand and ostentatiously examined her fingernails. It was meant to signal that she couldn't give a shit about Bilohan's proviso. The king didn't decode the signal, or if he did, he concealed it skillfully.
"It has reached our ears," he puffed angrily, "that the Honourable Madam Nair makes magical concoctions available to womenfolk who don't want children, and helps those who are already pregnant to abort the fetus. We here in Kerak consider such a practice immoral."
"What a woman has a natural right to," replied Coral dryly, "cannot ipso facto be immoral."
"A woman,"
the king straightened up his skinny frame on the throne,
"has the right to expect only two gifts from a man, a child in the summer and thin bast slippers in the winter. Both the former and the latter gifts are intended to keep the woman at home, since the home is the proper place for a woman, ascribed to her by nature. A woman with a swollen belly and offspring clinging to her frock will not stray from the home, and no foolish ideas will occur to her, which guarantees her man peace of mind. A man with peace of mind can labour hard for the purpose of increasing the wealth and prosperity of his king. Neither do any foolish ideas occur to a man confident of his marriage, while toiling by the sweat of his brow and with his nose to the grindstone. But if someone tells a woman she can have a child when she wants, and when she doesn't, she mustn't, and when, to cap it all, someone offers a method and passes her a physic, then, honourable lady, then the social order begins to totter."
"That's right," interjected Prince Xander, who had been waiting for some time for a chance to interject.
"Precisely. A woman who is averse to motherhood," continued Bilohan. "A woman whose belly, the cradle, and a host of brats don't imprison her in the homestead, soon yields to carnal urges. The matter is indeed obvious and inevitable. Then a man loses his inner calm and balanced state of mind. Something suddenly goes out of kilter and stinks in his former harmony. Nay, it turns out that there is no harmony or order. In particular, there is none of the order that justifies the daily grind. And the truth is, I appropriate the results of that hard work. And from such thoughts, it's but a single step to upheaval, to sedition, rebellion, revolt. Do you see, Nair?" Whoever gives womenfolk contraceptive agents or enables pregnancies to be terminated undermines the social order and incites riots and rebellion.
That is so, interjected Xander. Absolutely.
Litta didn't care about Bilohun's outer trappings of authority and imperiousness. She knew perfectly well that as a sorceress she was immune, and that all the king could do was talk. However, she refrained from bluntly bringing to his attention that things had been out of kilter and stinking in his kingdom for ages, that there was next to no order in it, and that the only harmony known to his subjects was a harlot of the same name at the portside brothel. And mixing up in it women and motherhood, or aversion to motherhood, was evidence not only of misogyny, but also imbecility. Instead of that, she said the following. In your lengthy disquisition, you keep stubbornly returning to the themes of increasing wealth and prosperity. I understand you perfectly, since my own prosperity is also extremely dear to me. And not for all the world would I give up anything that prosperity provides me with. I judge that a woman has the right to have children when she wants, and not to have them when she doesn't. But I shall not enter into a debate in that regard. After all, everyone has the right to some opinion or other. I merely point out that I charge a fee for the medical help I give women. It's quite a significant source of my income. We have a free market economy, Your Majesty. Please don't interfere with the sources of my income. Because my income, as you well know, is also the income of the chapter and the entire consorority. And the consorority reacts extremely badly to any attempts to diminish its income.
Are you trying to threaten me, Nair?
The very thought. Not only am I not, but I declare my far-reaching help and collaboration. Know this, Bilohun, that if, as a result of the exploitation and plunder you're engaged in, unrest occurs in Kerak, if, speaking grandiloquently, the fire of rebellion flares up, or if a rebellious rabble comes to drag you out by the balls, dethrone you and hang you forthwith from a dry branch, then you'll be able to count on my consorority. And the sorcerers. We'll come to your aid. We shan't allow revolt or anarchy, because they don't suit us either. So keep on exploiting and increasing your wealth. Feel free, and don't interfere with others doing the same. That's my request and advice.
Advice? Fumed Xander, rising from his seat. You advising my father? My father is the king. Kings don't listen to advice. Kings command. Sit down and be quiet, son.
Bilohun grimaced.
And you, witch, listen carefully. I have something to say to you.
Yes?
I'm taking a new lady wife. 17 years old. A little cherry, I tell you. A cherry on a tart.
My congratulations.
I'm doing it for dynastic reasons, out of concern for the succession and order in the land.
Egmund, previously silent as the grave, jerked his head up.
Succession, he snarled,
and the evil glint in his eyes didn't escape Litter's notice.
What succession? You have 6 sons and 8 daughters, including bastards. What more do you want?
You can see for yourself.
Bilohun waved a bony hand.
You can see for yourself, Nair. I have to look after the succession. Am I to leave the kingdom and the crown to someone who addresses his parent thus? Fortunately, I'm still alive and reigning, and I mean to reign for a long time. As I said, I'm wedding...
What of it?
Where she...
The king scratched behind an ear and glanced at Litter from under half-closed eyelids.
Where she... I mean my new young wife, to ask you for those physics. I forbid you from giving them, because I'm against physics like that, because they're immoral.
We can agree on that. Coral smiled charmingly. If your little cherry asks, I won't give her anything, I promise.
I understand. Bilohan brightened up.
Why, how splendidly we've come to agreement. The crux is mutual understanding and respect. One must even differ with grace.
That's right, interjected Xander. Egmund bristled and swore under his breath.
In the spirit of respect and understanding,
Coral twisted a ginger ringlet around a finger and looked up at the plafond.
And also out of concern for harmony and order in your country, I have some information, confidential information. I consider informants repellent, but fraudsters and thieves even more so. And this concerns impudent embezzlement, Your Majesty. People are trying to rob you.
Bilohan leaned forward from his throne, grimacing like a wolf.
Who? I want names.
Kerak, a city in the northern kingdom of Sidaris, at the mouth of the river Adalat. Once the capital of the independent kingdom of Kerak, which, as the result of inept governments and the extinction of the royal line, fell into decline, lost its significance, and became parcelled up by its neighbours and incorporated into them. It has a port, several factories, a lighthouse, and roughly 2,000 residents. Effenberg and Talbot, Encyclopaedia Maxima Mundi, Volume 8. Chapter 2. The bay bristled with masts and filled with sails, some white, some many-coloured. The larger ships stood at anchor, protected by a headland and a breakwater. In the port itself, smaller and absolutely tiny vessels were moored alongside wooden jetties. Almost all of the free space on the beach was occupied by boats, or the remains of boats. A white and red brick lighthouse, originally built by the elves and later renovated, stood tall at the end of the headland, where it was being buffeted by white breakers. The Witcher spurred his mare in her sides. Roach raised her head and flared her nostrils, as though also enjoying the smell of the sea breeze. Urged on, she set off across the dunes, towards the city now nearby. The city of Kerak, the chief metropolis of the kingdom bearing the same name, was divided into three separate, distinct zones, straddling both banks at the mouth of the river Adalat. The port complex, with docks and an industrial and commercial centre, including a shipyard and workshops, as well as food processing plants, warehouses and stores, was located on the left bank of the Adalat. The river's right bank, an area called Palmyra, was occupied by the shacks and cottages of labourers and paupers, the houses and stalls of small traders, abattoirs and shambles, and numerous bars and dens that only livened up after nightfall, since Palmyra was also the district of entertainment and forbidden pleasures. It was also quite easy, as Geralt knew well, to lose one's purse or get a knife in the ribs there. Kerak proper, an area consisting of narrow streets running between the houses of wealthy merchants and financiers, manufactories, banks, pawnbrokers, shoemakers and tailor shops, and large and small stores, was situated further away from the sea, on the left bank, behind a high palisade of robust stakes. Located there were also taverns, coffee houses and inns of superior category, including establishments offering, indeed, much the same as the port quarter of Palmyra, but at considerably higher prices. The centre of the district was a quadrangular town square featuring the town hall, the theatre, the courthouse, the customs office and the houses of the city's elite. A statue of the city's founder, King Osmic, dreadfully spattered in bird droppings, stood on a plinth in the middle of the town square. It was a downright lie, as a seaside town had existed there long before Osmic arrived from the devil knows where. Higher up, on a hill, stood the castle and the royal palace, which were quite unusual in terms of form and shape. It had previously been a temple, which was abandoned by its priests, embittered by the townspeople's total lack of interest, and then modified and extended. The temple's campanile, or bell tower, and its bell had even survived, which the incumbent King Bilohan ordered to be tolled every day at noon, and, clearly, just to spite his subjects, at midnight. The bell sounded as the Witcher began to ride between Palmyra's cottages. Palmyra stank of fish, laundry and cheap restaurants, and the crush in the streets was dreadful, which cost the Witcher a great deal of time and patience to negotiate the streets. He breathed a sigh when he finally arrived at the bridge and crossed onto the Adalat's left bank. The water smelled foul and bore scuds of dense foam, waste from the tannery located upstream. From that point, it wasn't far to the road leading to the palisaded city. Geralt left his horse in the stables outside the city centre, paying for 2 days in advance, and giving the stableman some backsheesh in order to ensure that Roach was adequately cared for. He headed towards the watchtower. One could only enter Kerak through the watchtower after undergoing a search and the rather unpleasant procedures accompanying it. This necessity somewhat angered the Witcher, but he understood its purpose. The fancier townspeople weren't especially overjoyed at the thought of visits by guests from dockside Palmyra, particularly in the form of mariners from foreign parts putting ashore there. He entered the watchtower, a log building that he knew accommodated the guardhouse. He thought he knew what to expect. He was wrong. He had visited numerous guardhouses in his life, small, medium, and large, both nearby and in quite distant parts of the world, some in more and less civilized, and some quite uncivilized regions. All the world's guardhouses stank of mold, sweat, leather and urine, as well as iron and the grease used to preserve it. It was no different in the Kerak guardhouse. Or it wouldn't have been, had the classic guardhouse smell not been drowned out by the heavy, choking, floor-to-ceiling odour of farts. There could be no doubt that leguminous plants, most likely peas and beans, prevailed in the diet of the guardhouse's crew. And the garrison was wholly female. It consisted of 6 women currently sitting at a table and busy with their midday meal. They were all greedily slurping some morsels floating in a thin paprika sauce from earthenware bowls. The tallest guard, clearly the commandant, pushed her bowl away and stood up. Geralt, who always maintained there was no such thing as an ugly woman, suddenly felt compelled to revise his opinion.
"Weapons on the bench!"
The commandant's head, like those of her comrades, was shaven. Her hair had managed to grow back a little, giving rise to patchy stubble on her bald head. The muscles of her midriff showed from beneath her unbuttoned waistcoat and gaping shirt, bringing to mind a netted pork roast. The guard's biceps, to remain on the subject of cooked meat, were the size of hams.
"Put your weapons on the bench," she repeated. "You deaf!"
One of her subordinates, still hunched over her bowl, raised herself a little and farted, loud and long. Her companions guffawed. Geralt fanned himself with a glove. The guard looked at his swords.
"Hey, girls, get over here."
The girls stood up rather reluctantly, stretching. Their style of clothing, Geralt noticed, was quite informal, mainly intended to show off their musculature. One of them was wearing leather shorts with the legs split at the seams to accommodate her thighs. 2 belts crossing her chest were pretty much all she had on above the waist.
"A witcher," she stated. "2 swords, steel and silver."
Another, like all of them, tall and broad-shouldered, approached, tugged open Geralt's shirt unceremoniously, and pulled out his medallion by the silver chain.
"He has a sign," she stated. "There's a wolf on it, fangs bared. Would seem to be a witcher. Do we let him through?" "Rules don't prohibit it. He's handed over his swords."
"That's correct."
Geralt joined the conversation in a calm voice.
"Aham. They'll both remain, I presume, in safe deposit, to be reclaimed on production of a docket, which you're about to give me."
The guards surrounded him, grinning. One of them prodded him, apparently by accident. Another farted thunderously.
"That's your receipt," she snorted. "A witcher? A hired monster killer, and he gave up his swords at once, meek as a schoolboy. Bet he'd turn his cock over as well, if we ordered him to. Let's do it then, eh, girls? And whip it out? We'll see what witch's cocks are like."
"Here we go," snapped the commandant. "They're off now, the sluts. Gone, Skarek, get here. Gone, Skarek."
A balding elderly gentleman, in a dun mantle and woolen beret, emerged from the next room. Immediately he entered, he had a coughing fit, took off his beret and began to fan himself with it. He took the swords, wrapped in their belts, and gestured for Geralt to follow him. The Witcher didn't linger. Intestinal gases had definitely begun to predominate in the noxious mixture of the guardhouse. The room they entered was split down the middle by a sturdy iron grating. The large key the elderly gentleman opened it with grated in the lock. He hung the swords on a hook beside other sabres, claymores, broadswords and cutlasses. He opened a scruffy register, scrawled slowly and lengthily in it, coughing incessantly and struggling to catch his breath. He finally handed Geralt the completed receipt.
"Am I to understand that my swords are safe here, locked away and under guard?"
The dun-clad elderly gentleman, puffing and panting heavily, locked the grating and showed him the key. It didn't convince Geralt. Any grating could be forced, and the noisy flatulence of the ladies from the guardhouse was capable of drowning out any attempt at burglary. But there was no choice. He had to accomplish in Kerak what he had come to do, and leave the city as soon as he could. The tavern, or, as the sign declared, the Natura Rerum Osteria, was a small but tasteful building of cedar wood, with a steep roof and a chimney sticking up high out of it. The building's facade was decorated by a porch with steps leading to it, surrounded by spreading aloe plants in wooden tubs. The smell of cooking, mainly meat roasting on a gridiron, drifted from the tavern. The scents were so enticing that right away it seemed to the Witcher that Natura Rerum was an Eden, a garden of delights, an island of happiness, a retreat for the blessed, flowing with milk and honey. It soon turned out that this Eden, like every Eden, was guarded. It had its own Cerberus, a guard with a flaming sword. Geralt had the chance to see him in action. Before his very eyes, the guard, a short but powerfully built fellow, was driving a skinny young man from the Garden of Delights. The young man was protesting, shouting and gesticulating, which clearly annoyed the guard.
"You're barred, Muus, as well you know, so be off. I won't say it again."
The young man moved away from the steps quickly enough to avoid being pushed. He was, Geralt noticed, prematurely balding, his long, thin hair only beginning somewhere in the region of his crown, which gave a generally rather unprepossessing impression.
"Fuck you and your bane!"
yelled the young man from a safe distance.
"I don't need any favours. You aren't the only ones. I'll go to the competition. Big heads, upstarts. The sign may be gilded, but there's still dung on your boots. You mean as much to me as that dung, and shit will always be shit."
Geralt was slightly worried. The balding young man, apart from his unsightly looks, was dressed in quite a grand fashion. Perhaps not too richly, but in any case more elegantly than the Witcher. So if elegance was the determining criterion...
"And where might you be going, may I ask?"
The guard's icy voice interrupted his train of thought and confirmed his fears.
"This is an exclusive tavern," continued the Cerberus, blocking the stairs. "Do you understand the meaning of the word? It's off limits, as it were, to some people."
"Why to me?"
"Don't judge a book by its cover."
The guard looked down on the Witcher from two steps higher up.
"You're a foreigner, a walking illustration of that old folk saying. Your cover is nothing to write home about. Perhaps there are other objects hidden in its pages, but I shan't pry. I repeat, this is an exclusive tavern. We don't tolerate people dressed like ruffians here, or armed."
"I'm not armed."
"But you look like you are. So kindly, take yourself off somewhere else." "Control yourself, Tarp."
A swarthy man in a short velvet jacket appeared in the doorway of the tavern. His eyebrows were bushy, his gaze piercing, and his nose aquiline and large.
"You clearly don't know who you're dealing with,"
the aquiline nose informed the guard.
"You don't know who has come to visit."
The guard's lengthening silence showed he indeed did not.
"Geralt of Rivia, the Witcher, known for protecting people and saving their lives, as he did a week ago, here in our region, in Ansegis, when he saved a mother and her child. And several months earlier, he famously killed a man eating Lucrot in Sismar, suffering wounds in so doing. How could you buy entry to my tavern to somebody who plies such an honest trade? On the contrary, I am very happy to see a guest like him, and I consider it an honor that he desires to visit me. Master Geralt, the Natura Rerum Osteria warmly welcomes you. I am Phoebus Ravenga, the owner of this humble house."
The table that the head waiter sat him at had a tablecloth. All the tables in the Natura Rerum most of which were occupied, had tablecloths. Geralt couldn't recall the last time he'd seen any in a tavern. Although curious, he didn't look around, not wanting to appear provincial and uncouth. However, a cautious glance revealed modest, though elegant and tasteful decor. The clientele, whom he judged to be mainly merchants and craftsmen, were also elegantly, although not always tastefully, attired. There were ship's captains, weather-beaten and bearded, and there was no shortage of garishly dressed noblemen. It smelled nice and elegant, of roast meat, garlic, caraway, and big money. He felt eyes on him. His witcher senses immediately signalled whenever he was being observed. He had a quick, discreet look around. A young woman with fox-red hair was observing him, also very discreetly, and, to an ordinary mortal, imperceptibly. She was pretending to be completely absorbed in her meal, something tasty-looking and temptingly fragrant even from a distance. Her style and body language left no doubt. Not to a witcher. He would have bet anything she was a sorceress. The head waiter shook him out of his contemplation and sudden nostalgia.
"Today," he announced ceremonially, and not without pride, "we propose veal shanks stewed in vegetables with mushrooms and beans, saddle of lamb roast with aubergines, bacon and beer served with glazed plums, roast shoulder of boar served with stewed apples, fried duck breasts served with red cabbage and cranberries, squid stuffed with chicory and a white sauce served with grapes, grilled monkfish in a cream sauce served with stewed pears, or, as usual, our speciality, goose legs in white wine with a choice of baked fruit and turbot in caramelized cuttlefish ink, served with crayfish necks."
"If you have a liking for fish," Fabus Ravenga suddenly appeared at the table out of the blue, "I heartily recommend the turbot. From the morning catch, it goes without saying, the pride and boast of our head chef."
"The turbot and ink, then."
The witcher fought against an irrational desire to order several dishes in one go, aware it would have been in bad taste.
"Thank you for the suggestion. I've begun to suffer the agony of choice."
"Which wine," the head waiter asked, "would sir like to order?"
"Please choose something suitable. I'm not very au fait with wines."
"Few are," smiled Fabus Ravenga. "And very few admitted. Never fear, we shall choose the type and vintage, Master Witcher. I'll leave you in peace. Bon appétit."
That wish was not to come true. Neither did Geralt have the opportunity to find out what wine they would choose. The taste of turbot in cuttlefish ink was also to remain a mystery to him that day. The red-haired woman suddenly abandoned discretion as her eyes found his. She smiled. Spitefully, he couldn't help feeling. He felt a quiver run through him.
"The witcher called Geralt of Rivia?"
The question was asked by one of three characters dressed in black, who had noiselessly approached the table.
"It is I." "You are arrested, in the name of the law."
What judgment shall I dread, doing no wrong? William Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice. Chapter 3. Geralt's court-appointed barrister avoided eye contact. She flicked through the portfolio of documents with a persistence worthy of a better cause. There were very few papers in it. Two, to be precise. His lawyer had probably learned them by heart. To dazzle them with her speech for the defence, he hoped. But that was, he suspected, a forlorn hope.
"You assaulted two of your cellmates while under arrest."
His lawyer finally raised her eyes.
"Ought I perhaps to know the reason?"
"Primo, I rejected their sexual advances. They didn't want to understand that no means no. Secundo, I like beating people up. Tertio, it's a falsehood. They self-inflicted their wounds by banging themselves against the wall to slander me."
He spoke slowly and carelessly. After a week spent in prison, he had become utterly indifferent. His barrister closed the portfolio, only to open it again straight away. Then she tidied her elaborate coiffure.
"The victims aren't pressing charges, it transpires," she sighed. "Let us focus on the prosecutor's charge. The tribunal assessor is accusing you of a grave crime, punishable by a severe penalty."
How could it be otherwise, he thought,
contemplating the lawyer's features. He wondered how old she had been when she entered the school for sorcerers, and how old she was when she left. The two schools for sorcerers, Banard School for Boys and Aratusa School for Girls, both on the Isle of Thanet, apart from male and female graduates, also produced rejects. In spite of the strict selection procedure of their entry examinations, which was supposed to facilitate the winnowing out and discarding of hopeless cases, it was only the first semesters that really found and revealed the ones who had managed to remain hidden. The ones for whom thinking turned out to be a disagreeable and hazardous experience. Latent idiots, sluggards and intellectual slackers of both sexes, who had no place in schools of magic. The difficulty was that they were usually the offspring of wealthy people, or considered important for other reasons. After being expelled from school, it was necessary to do something with these difficult youngsters. There was no problem for the boys rejected by Banard. They joined the diplomatic service, the army, navy, or police, while politics was left for the stupidest. Magical rejects in the shape of the fairer sex seemed to be more difficult to place. Although expelled, the young ladies had, nonetheless, crossed the threshold of a school of magic and had tasted magic to some degree or other. And the influence of sorceresses on monarchs and on all areas of political and economic life was too powerful for the young ladies to be left in the lurch. They were provided with a safe haven. They joined the judiciary. They became lawyers. The Defence Council closed the portfolio, then opened it. "I recommend an admission of guilt," she said. "Then we can expect a more lenient punishment."
"Admit to what?" interrupted the Witcher.
"When the judge asks if you plead guilty, you are to reply in the affirmative. An admission of guilt will be regarded as a mitigating circumstance."
"How do you mean to defend me, then?"
The lawyer closed the portfolio, as though it were a coffin lid.
"Let's go. The judge is waiting."
The judge was waiting. For right then, the previous miscreant was being escorted from the courtroom.
"He looks none too cheerful," thought Geralt.
A shield, flecked with flies bearing the emblem of Kerak, a blue dolphin neant, hung on the wall. Under the coat of arms was the bench with three people sitting behind it. A scrawny scribe, a faded sub-judge, and the judge, a woman of equable appearance and countenance. The bench on the judge's right was occupied by the tribunal assessor, acting as prosecutor. He looked serious. Serious enough to avoid an encounter with him in a dark alley. On the other side, on the judge's left, was the dock, the place assigned to Geralt. Things moved quickly after that.
"Geralt, called Geralt of Rivia, a witcher by profession, is accused of embezzlement, of the seizure and misappropriation of crown property. Acting in league with other persons whom he corrupted, the accused inflated the fees on the bills issued for his services with the intention of arrogating those surpluses, which resulted in losses to the state treasury. The proof is a report, Notitia Criminis, that the prosecution has enclosed in the file. That report..."
The judge's weary expression and absent gaze clearly showed that this respectable lady was miles away, and that quite other matters and problems were distressing her. The laundry, the children, the colour of the curtains, preparing the dough for a poppy seed cake, and the stretch marks on her large behind auguring a marital crisis. The Witcher humbly accepted the fact that he was less important, that he could not compete with anything of that kind.
"The crime committed by the accused," the prosecutor continued without emotion, "not only damages the country, but also undermines the social order and spreads dissent. The law demands..."
"The report included in the file," interrupted the judge, "has to be treated by the court as probatio de relato, evidence supplied by a third party. Can the prosecution supply any other proof?"
"There is no other evidence. For the moment. The accused is, as has been pointed out, a witcher. He is a mutant beyond the margins of human society, flouting human laws and placing himself above them. In his criminogenic and antisocial profession, he communes with criminals, as well as non-humans, including races traditionally hostile to humanity. Law-breaking is part of a witcher's nihilistic nature. In the case of this witcher, Your Honour, the lack of evidence is the best proof. It proves perfidy, and does the accused..."
The judge was clearly uninterested in whatever the lack of evidence proved.
"Does the accused plead guilty?"
"He does not."
Geralt ignored his lawyer's desperate signals.
"I am innocent. I haven't committed any crime."
He had some skill. He had dealt with the law. He had also familiarized himself with the literature on the subject.
"I am accused on the basis of prejudice."
"Objection!"
yelled the assessor.
The accused is making a speech.
Objection dismissed. As a result of prejudice against my person and my profession, i.e., as a result of prejudicium. Prejudicium implies in advance a falsehood. Furthermore, I stand accused on the grounds of an anonymous denunciation, and only one. Testimonium unius non valet. Testis unus, testis nullus. Ergo, it is not an accusation, but conjecture, i.e., presumptio, and conjecture leaves doubt.
In dubio pro reo.
The defence counsel roused herself.
In dubio pro reo, Your Honour.
The court has decided to set bail of 500 Novigradian crowns.
The judge struck her gavel on the bench, waking up the faded sub-judge. Geralt sighed. He wondered if both his cellmates had come around and drawn any kind of lesson from the matter, or whether he would have to give them another hiding. What is the city but the people? William Shakespeare, Coriolanus. Chapter 4. A stall, carelessly nailed together from planks, manned by an old deer in a straw hat, and as plump and ruddy-faced as a good witch from a fairy tale, stood at the very edge of the crowded marketplace. The sign above the old deer read, "Come to me for joy and happiness. Gherkin complimentary." Geralt stopped and dug some copper pennies from his pocket.
"Pour me a gill of happiness, Granny," he demanded gloomily.
He took a deep breath, downed it in one, and breathed out. He wiped away the tears that the hooch brought to his eyes. He was at liberty, and angry. He had learned that he was free, interestingly, from a person he knew, by sight. It was the same prematurely bald young man who he had observed being driven from the steps of the Natura Rerum Osteria, and who, it turned out, was the court scribe.
"You're free,"
the bald young man had told him, locking and unlocking his thin, ink-stained fingers.
"Someone came up with the bail."
"Who?"
The information turned out to be confidential. The bald scribbler refused to give it. He also refused, rather bluntly, the return of Geralt's confiscated purse, which contained cash and bank checks, among other things. The witcher's personal property, he declared, not without spitefulness, had been treated by the authorities as a
"cautio pro expensis,"
a down payment against court costs and expected penalties. There was no point or purpose in arguing. On release, Geralt had to content himself with what he had in his pockets when he was arrested. Personal trifles and petty cash. So petty, no one had bothered to steal it. He counted the remaining copper pennies and smiled at the old deer.
"And a gill of joy, please. I'll decline the gherkin."
After the old deer's hooch, the world took on a more beautiful hue. Geralt knew it would quickly pass, so he quickened his step. He had things to do. Roach, his mare, had fortunately escaped the attentions of the court and wasn't included in the cost of the cautio pro expensis. She was where he'd left her, in the stable stall, well-groomed and fed. The witcher couldn't accept something like that without a reward, irrespective of his own assets. The stableman received, at once, a few of the handful of silver coins that had survived in a hiding place sewn into the saddle. Geralt's generosity took the man's breath away. The horizon over the sea was darkening. It seemed to Geralt that he could see flashes of lightning there. Before entering the guardhouse, he prudently filled his lungs with fresh air. It didn't help. The guardswomen must have eaten more beans than usual that day. Many, many more beans. Who knew? Perhaps it was Sunday. Some of them were eating, as usual. Others were busy playing dice. They stood up from the table upon seeing him, and surrounded him.
"The witcher! Just look," said the commandant, standing very close.
"He's up and come here. I'm leaving the city. I've come to collect my property."
"If we lets you."
Another guard prodded him with an elbow, apparently by accident.
"What will he give us for it? You'll have to buy yourself out, sonny. Buy yourself out, eh, lasses? What'll we make him do? Kiss all our bare asses? With a lick and a dick?"
"Nothing of the kind. He might infect us with something."
"But he'll have to give us some pleasure, won't he?"
Another one
pushed her rock-hard bust onto him.
"He can sing as an air."
Another one farted thunderously.
"And fit the tune to my pitch."
"Or mine."
Yet another one farted even louder.
"Mine's more full-blooded."
The other women laughed so much they clasped their sides. Geralt made his way through, trying hard not to use excessive force. At that moment, the door to the deposit opened, and an elderly gentleman in a grey mantle and beret appeared. The attendant, Gonskorek. On seeing the Witcher, he opened his mouth wide.
"You, sir?"
he mumbled.
"How so? Your swords?"
"Indeed, my swords. May I have them?"
But...
Gonskorek choked and clutched his chest, struggling to catch his breath.
But I don't have the swords."
"I beg your pardon."
"I don't have them."
Gonskorek's face flushed and contorted as though in a paroxysm of pain.
"Them been took? What?"
Geralt felt cold fury gripping him.
"Been took?
What do you mean, taken?"
He grabbed the attendant by the lapels.
"Taken by whom, damn it? What the bloody hell is this about?"
"The docket."
"Exactly."
He felt an iron grip on his arm. The commandant of the guard shoved him away from the choking Gonskorek.
"Exactly. Show us the docket."
The Witcher did not have the docket. The docket from the weapon store had been in his purse. The purse the court had confiscated, against the costs and the expected punishments.
"The docket. I don't have it, but no docket, no deposit."
The commandant didn't let him finish.
"Sword's been took, didn't you hear? You probably took him, and now you're putting on this pantomime. Want to con something out of us? Nothing doing. Get out of here."
"I'm not leaving until..." The commandant, without loosening her grasp, dragged Geralt away and turned him around to face the door.
"Fuck off!"
Geralt shied away from hitting women. He didn't, however, have any reluctance when it came to somebody who had the shoulders of a wrestler, a belly like a netted pork roast, and calves like a discus thrower, and on top of that, who farted like a mule. He pushed the commandant away and smashed her hard in the jaw with his favourite right hook. The others froze, but only for a second. Even before the commandant had tumbled onto the table, splashing beans and paprika sauce around, they were on him. He smashed one of them in the nose without thinking, and hit another so hard her teeth made a cracking noise. He treated two to the Ard sign. They flew like ragdolls into a stand of halberds, knocking them all over with an indescribable crash and clatter. He got hit in the ear by the commandant, who was dripping sauce. The other guard, the one with the rock-hard bust, seized him from behind in a bear hug. He elbowed her so hard she howled. He pushed the commandant onto the table again and whacked her with a haymaker. He thumped the one with the smashed nose in the solar plexus and knocked her to the ground, where she vomited audibly. Another, struck in the temple, slammed her head against a post and went limp, her eyes immediately misting over. But four of them were still on their feet. That marked the end of his advantage. He was hit in the back of the head, and then in the ear, and after that in the lower back. One of them tripped him up, and when he fell down, two dropped on him, pinning him down and pounding him with their fists. The other two weighed in with kicks. A headbutt in the face took out one of the women lying on him, but the other immediately pressed him down. The commandant. He recognized her by the sauce dripping from her. She smacked him from above in the teeth. He spat blood right in her eyes.
"A knife!"
she yelled, thrashing her shaven head around.
"Give me a knife! I'll cut his balls off!"
"Why a knife?" yelled another.
"I'll bite them off!" "Stop! Attention! What is the meaning of this? Attention, I said!"
A stentorian voice, commanding respect, tore through the hubbub of the fracas, pacifying the guards. They released Geralt from their grasp. He got up with difficulty, somewhat sore. The sight of the battlefield improved his humour a little. He observed his accomplishments with some satisfaction. The guard, lying by the wall, had opened her eyes, but was still unable even to sit upright. Another bent over with spitting blood and feeling her teeth with a finger. Yet another, the one with a smashed nose, was trying hard to stand but kept falling over, slipping in a puddle of her own beany vomit. Only three of the six could keep their balance, so he could be satisfied with the result, despite the fact that had it not been for the intervention, he would have suffered more serious injuries and might not have been able to get up unaided. The person who had intervened, however, was an elegantly attired man with noble features, emanating authority. Geralt didn't know who he was, but he knew perfectly well who the noble-looking man's companion was. A dandy in a fanciful hat with an egret feather stuck into it, with shoulders.